Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, how more wildfires are unraveling decades of progress on air quality, and the poetry of Tennessee's Jane Hicks. First, education contributor Bridget Blom has two guests this week to focus on absenteeism in schools, now at 30% in Kentucky.
Today, we're talking with Hetty Chang, a renowned expert in the field of education and student attendance. Hetty is the founder and executive director of Attendance Works, a nonprofit initiative dedicated to reducing chronic absenteeism. And later in this segment, we'll speak with Deneen Sargent, director of pupil personnel at Rowan County Schools, to understand the perspective from a school district. So with that, Hetty, why is attending school still important?
We actually created a toolkit because we realized that we need to message again why going to school matters so much. And I think about it as showing up matters for real. And the R stands for routine, because when we show up every day, we're in that regular routine that is so important for our mental well-being, for reducing anxiety and stress, especially in the aftermath of a pandemic where we've had sort of chaotic and disrupted routines of learning. And actually having a regular routine of attendance is really important for kids, because eventually when they go to work, employers will expect that you know how to still show up regularly. But then E is for engagement, because when you're in school, you can get connected to adults and to kids. And there is something about in-person connection and talking to people and learning how to socialize and be around people that is a crucial part of what being in school is all about. And then it's about access to resources, because at school, we saw this in the pandemic. This is why we had a huge effort around food and nutrition, because kids depend on school for that. But it's also access into enrichment, to sports, to all sorts of opportunities, health services. Kentucky's had a huge investment in family support centers and youth development centers. That was part of a school reform many years ago that was instituted. But you got to get to school to benefit from all of that. And then it's important for learning. Because what we know is that when kids miss too much school, starting in pre-K and K, it can lead to not reading proficiently by the end of third grade, not doing well in middle school, even getting suspended more, and then not graduating from high school.
So we have routines, engagement, access to resources, and learning. And all those things happen when kids show up to school and when families support kids showing up to school.
Absolutely.
Hetty, what are some of the primary causes? I mentioned, this kind of response to pandemic time learning. But even before the pandemic, there were issues with chronic absenteeism that surely led you to found the organization you lead. What are some of the primary causes of chronic absenteeism?
Yeah, so we've thought about root causes as falling into four buckets: barriers, aversion, disengagement, and misconceptions. And these buckets were true before the pandemic, but what goes in them is a little bit different. So barriers, chronic and acute illness, family responsibilities, trauma, poor transportation, housing and food insecurity. By the way, a lot of those barriers got much harder. We have a bus driver shortage. Kids who were in communities that experienced a lot of COVID, experienced extraordinary trauma that takes years to overcome if you lost a beloved family member. Kids lack access to needed health services, and sometimes during the pandemic, they didn't get them. So these are barriers that got exacerbated during the pandemic. So when kids aren't showing up to school, it's not just because they don't think it's important, but particularly for our highest poverty areas, the barriers got steeper and deeper during the pandemic and are still very challenging. We are having an unwinding of health insurance for our lowest income kids. That's a huge challenge. Then there's aversion. So anxiety, social and peer challenges, being bored. Now, one of the things that happened in the pandemic we saw is kids missed out sporadically for different parts of learning. And then the problem is learning is scaffolded. So then when they want to come back to school, they don't feel like they are you know, effective in the classroom. And so then they become anxious. We hear about anxiety and depression as huge barriers that I never heard about before as much this before school. And then there's disengagement, where kids don't have meaningful connections and relationships to adults. And certainly when we close schools, you know, that became a challenge. And then as we reopen schools and we face staffing shortages, that becomes a challenge, because what engages kids in learning, engages kids in school, is they know an adult cares about them and that there are kids in school who care about them and feel connected to them. And those relationships have been harder. And then there are misconceptions. So certainly before the pandemic, you had challenges. People didn't realize missing just 2 days a month can throw you off track, or particularly with our youngest learners, you know, kindergarten doesn't matter that much when in fact it does. Those misconceptions might still be true. But in addition, one of the things I think that was so hard during the pandemic is people got this window into classrooms with watching what was happening in virtual instruction.
Mm. Yeah. And they were oftentimes disappointed. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. It was disappointing at times. But we have to remember, teachers had to start at scale with virtual instruction with no warning, no training. Okay, it wasn't maybe that good at mm-hmm. times. A few exceptions, but a lot of folks who were struggling. But now they're back into the classroom, where I don't think we can say virtual instruction necessarily reflects what's back in the classroom. But there might be this misconception then that what happened in the classroom wasn't so meaningful. But the other thing that we are seeing, and I've heard this actually from some educators in Kentucky as well as other places, is families actually don't understand when to show up to school when kids are sick and when to keep them home. During the pandemic, we got really good. Any sign of illness, you stay home. That is not the case anymore. We're in a different place with COVID. It is thankfully not such a deadly disease. It is still problematic for some kids, and I want to acknowledge that. But there's a lot of things like sniffles that are not about COVID. They are about having allergies, stomach aches, which are about anxiety. And so we have to become much more thoughtful and selective about when we keep our kids home for illness. I don't want kids who are contagious and who are really sick coming to school. But there are a lot of minor illnesses that don't make sense to keep kids home for. Yeah. And that, though, we have to change public mindsets again, because we had 2 years of being accustomed to stay home for any reason.
So, Hedy, you touched on the role of families in really thinking through the importance of school again, underscoring the importance of school with their young people, and getting back to good practices for showing up. What role can communities play? And are there specific things that community-based organizations, communities writ large, can do to help us get back to a space where we are underscoring the importance of school and supporting young people to attend regularly?
I don't think it's unrealistic for us to expect that schools alone can get us back into this regular routine of attendance. And communities can do a whole set of things. One is sometimes these barriers, let's say transportation, community members can help with that. Let's say it's a not safe path to school. Well, you can do walking school buses. Let's say the issue is that kids don't have enough connections to meaningful adults. You can have communities members who can play the role of mentors at school, and they can help to connect with kids, help to coach them through things, you know, and there is resources and supports. The other thing that communities can help do is around the messaging. So if we have to shift from saying stay home for, you know, any symptom of illness to showing up matters for real, and we want folks to know that you should come to school if you're generally feeling okay, that's something that you can do. Billboards, you can have messaging about, like I've even seen communities where there's always the, you know, stores at the corner who kids when in high school aren't showing up. Two, they kind of go hang out in the corner store. Well, communities have long had partnerships with these stores where the owners put up flyers, but they also know that they can call someone at school and say, hey, got a couple of kids hanging out. Will you come? You know, and as a community, you're getting your kids back to school.
So if a state policymakers reach out to you and say, Hedy, what can we do as state policymakers, either with the force of law or regulation, to support kids getting back into school and some level of accountability around schooling? What do you say?
First of all, I think it's really important that we are taking our data accurately, we're looking at it in a comparable way, we're publishing it, and then we're using those resources to determine where we need to deepen our understanding of what are the barriers and challenges to going to school, and where we need to invest in resources like transportation, like mentoring, like support to get kids to school. I do think families have responsibilities to getting their kids to school, and we need to help remind families of that. But what we found is that it's a partnership with families to get kids to school, and that sometimes people want to take a more punitive approach, threaten families with court, with, you know, fines. And what we have never found is that there's any evidence that a punitive approach works, because the key to getting kids to show up to school is finding out why they're not showing up in the first place, and then offering resources that address that. So if kids aren't coming to school because, let's say, they are older kids, we find they're taking on more job responsibilities, they're taking on caring for their siblings, then you have to find out maybe partnerships with employers so that they can both be in a pathway to graduating from school, but also earning. If the challenge is housing security, then you got to work with housing partners to figure out how we address that. So if you start with threatening families, they will not tell you what the challenges they're really facing are. You have to have a positive problem-solving approach that uses data to know when you have to engage and reach out to families. And if you have high levels of chronic absence across an area, that means you really need a community collaborative figuring out how you do that.
A multifaceted problem which requires a multifaceted solution. Hedy Chang, CEO of Attendance Works, thank you so much for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
Now joining us is the Director of Pupil Personnel in Rouen County, Kentucky, Deneen Sargent, to explore the complexities surrounding chronic absenteeism, its impact on education outcomes, and to discuss strategies that work locally. Deneen, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What are the primary reasons you're seeing in Rouen County that are driving chronic absenteeism?
Now more than ever, we are seeing students who are dealing with anxiety on many levels. The anxiety can come from home life issues, family issues, just having a hard time coping and being in crowds, not wanting to be around a lot of people. Sickness, of course, plays a huge part in chronic absenteeism. Families are trying to navigate, when do I send kids to school? When do I not? And just knowing what is best to do. And we're finding also that students are sometimes even caretakers for family members at home or for younger siblings and those types of issues.
Have you seen a change on the other side of the pandemic relative to before? So what are some of the longstanding issues related to chronic absenteeism that are different than maybe some of the reasons you're seeing today? And are there targeted approaches that you're taking to stem the tide on this issue?
Well, most definitely we are seeing a huge increase in chronic absenteeism since the pandemic. I think, you know, the increase really has come from fear in families. Many families were and still are fearful of sending their children into buildings and large numbers of people. The COVID learning loss is real. But we must recognize that, and we have to move on from that. We can't live in the COVID learning loss. We have to learn how to navigate ways to help get students back on track. And the one way to do that is getting them back into schools. and some strategies that we have used in Rowan County, specifically this year. This is my first year as DPP. We are talking about chronic absenteeism more than we ever have. Before COVID, we rarely discussed chronic absenteeism. We tended to focus on truancy, those students who had more than the allotted number of unexcused absences.
So unpack the difference between those things for us a little bit, Deneen, chronic absenteeism and truancy.
Yes, and that's a great point because we do see a huge misconception with that. The conception with families is, what's the problem? I've turned in my doctor's notes and they're excused absences. And they're not unexcused, which would mean that a child is truant if they have six or more unexcused absences. Looking nationally, if you miss 10% of school days, you are considered chronically absent. And that doesn't matter if you have a doctor's excuse or a parent note to cover it. You are not physically in school. And if you're not in school, you're not learning. And educating our parents has been a big part of that. We are constantly talking about attendance and absenteeism and chronic absenteeism specifically. We just have to change that misconception that as long as the days are excused, that it's okay, because it's really not okay. So that's been a really big part for me and my focus when I took this role back in July. We make students and families more aware of their child's attendance through attendance tracker cards. We've created a slogan, Show Up Together RC. And of course, that's from Attendance Works. And I love Attendance Works and I navigate that site all the time. We send postcards to our students, letting them know that we miss them. But then on the flip side, recognizing those students with postcards to their families of students who are attending school like they should be 95% of the time or better. We even do a show up cup challenge to the school that has shown the most increase in their attendance percentage from 1 month to the next. Another thing that we have really focused on this year is with our school calendar and the school calendar for 24-25. Focusing on some long weekends and full week times to encourage families now in February, when you get that calendar, you're going to know those days that we're going to be out of school. And we're focusing that calendar all around attendance. We specifically put these days in the calendar so you have them now to plan doctor's appointments, to plan family vacations, to plan long weekends around these times that we have in our calendar. Just really talking attendance all the time and being intentional about it, that's the main strategy that we have tried to combat.
Are there specific strategies that you are finding work for students to kind of pull them back into that environment, the schooling environment where they may be hesitant because of anxiety or other issues? What it speaks to our students?
The supports that we can offer to kids. We are very fortunate with our local agencies that we partner with our Pathways and our Mountain Comprehensive Care, that we can bring in those mental health supports. And we actually have school-based services that we provide students, and the families sign up for those just to help kids to become more comfortable with being back in a large setting. Coming through the pandemic, they were out of school for so long that they truly are having anxiety around that. But we recognize that, and working with our youth service centers and our community schools director, we're fortunate enough to have the AWARE grant, where we are actually talking today about hiring SEL coaches. And again, all of that, is tied back to helping students feel more comfortable with coming back to school.
Then how about community partners, business partners, community organizations? How are they helping with the messaging about why it's so important for students and families to reengage with school?
We are very fortunate. We have a lot of great community partners. We have our university here, St. Clair Hospital. We've partnered with them this year to provide a telehealth service for our students in school. And again, another way of keeping the child here, letting them see a telehealth provider. If there's a need for them to go home, then after that, we could call the parent to come and get them. It also helps our parents to not have to come and get the child and take them to a service provider, but we can offer that service to them right in our schools. And we have many business partners who will always offer rewards to students, and that being in the way of coupons to certain stores or just certain items for students, providing them with, you know, ice cream for kids who have a certain percentage of attendance, always celebrating the kids who have good attendance and celebrating kids who have grown in their attendance. That's always been an important part to me, because if a kid has been chronically absent and they're showing growth in that, we need to celebrate that child and let them know that we see that. And that comes through our service team meetings that we have weekly. In that service team meetings, we have all of those partners I just talked about in my AWARE grant, our SEL people. We have our nursing staff, our counselors. I mean, everybody. We're all around the table. And we are celebrating those kids who have grown in their attendance. And then we are naming and claiming kids to help break down those barriers with them and their family to get them to school if they are still being absent.
As the director of pupil personnel, are there resources you need from the community, from the state, that would make this job of getting kids back into school easier? Hetty mentioned nationally, transportation is an issue that is causing challenges with attendance. Mm-hmm. Rowan County being a rural area of our state, transportation is really important.
It is. It is important. And you hate to talk about funding of transportation, but for us, you know, if we had the opportunity to provide those extra services to kids after school hours and having those transportation services to take them home and to bring them to that service, that would be huge for us. It would totally be a game changer. You know, with virtual education, I believe that virtual education is here to stay. And we are currently working on reimagining our alternative and virtual education programs, because there is a need for kids to be virtual, and we recognize that. But instead of them going to a homeschool, I still want to be able to educate them. And if I can't see you face to face every day in a building, I want our teachers to be able to educate you virtually.
Deneen Sargent, Department of Pupil Personnel in Rowan County, thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Bridget Blom is President and CEO of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence. Coming up after the break, air for our bodies, poetry for our minds. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
This is Brian Burkhart with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Gateway Regional Arts Center in Mount Sterling will host An Intimate Evening with Laura Bell Bundy, 7 p.m. March 1st. Bundy, a Kentucky native, has an extensive Broadway career and will be speaking about stories from her life and from her experiences on stage. For tickets and more information, visit grackentucky.org. Another Kentucky native, bluegrass mandolinist Sam Bush, will perform at Frankfurt's Grand Theater, 7:30 p.m. March 1st. For tickets and information, visit thegrandky.com. And the Kentucky Arts Council will present the Kentucky Crafted Market March 9th and 10th at the Kentucky Horse Park's Alltech Arena. Admissions are free. For more information, visit the Arts Council's website, artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Brian Burkhart. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
There are reasons to be concerned that climate change is undoing progress in cleaning up the air we breathe. Those reasons are spelled out in a new report from the First Street Foundation. Joining us is Jeremy Porter, head of climate implications at First Street. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Jeremy.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So First Street's 10th National Risk Assessment has a very blunt subtitle, Atrocious Air. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that the focus of this report is really on the impact that climate and the changing climate is having on air quality across the U.S. As a little bit of a backstory, you hinted at the fact that we've done a really good job of improving air quality over the last half century and even a little bit longer than that from federal regulatory policies. I mean, we implemented the Pollution Control Act, then the Clean Air Act, a handful of amendments on that Clean Air Act, which instituted the EPA and other regulatory bodies. And we got to the point to where we've done a really, really good job of improving the air quality across the country, to the point to where some people thought that, you know, it was almost not possible to improve it much better in regard to the anthropogenic emissions that we were seeing from cars and from industry and things like that. But in about the last decade, we've started to see an upward trend in the same air pollution numbers. So if you can visualize sort of a downward trend and then almost a hockey stick curve in an upward trend over the last 10 years, what we're seeing now is that things like what's referred to as PM2.5 or wildfire smoke is starting to grow because we're starting to see increased intensity and severity of wildfires across the West, but also across the Southeast. And then we're also starting to see increases in ozone exposure across the Midwest and into the Northeast because of extreme heat exposure. So taken together, what that means is that we've done a really good job, even in a time when we think of how polarized government is and how bipartisan it is, we've been able to really improve the air quality as sort of a collective effort. It's sort of sad to think about the fact that now we're going to see all of those gains starting to reverse themselves with a process in climate change that we don't really have the ability to control in the same way that we did those regulations.
And does that reversal of that great progress that you just talked about, does it coincide with the onset of climate change, with especially the increase in temperatures?
Yeah, it is directly linked back to a lot of these climatological measurements. So increased temperatures are sort of the foundational measure. They're most directly related to increases in ozone exposure. As we're seeing more extreme heat exposure, increased temperatures, increased probability of heat waves, we're seeing that increased temperature interact with what are called precursor pollutants, just things like nitrous oxide, sulfur oxide, things that are in the air from cars and from industry and from factories. The extreme heat is interacting with those pollutants that are already in the air and creating more ground level ozone. And people are being exposed to that on the West Coast and throughout the Southeast. What we're also seeing is that those increased temperatures, the persistent drought environment, some of the decreasing humidity levels that we're seeing over time, decreases in precipitation in some parts of the country, are also contributing to the increase in wildfires. And the PM2.5 measure is a wildfire smoke measure, which the EPA has deemed as sort of a health issue for populations if they're persistently exposed to it. We're seeing that spike at a much, much faster rate across the West, simply due to the fact that we're seeing more wildfires in that area.
We've recently experienced a spike in wildfires in the eastern and central Kentucky area, but your report is especially bad news for the western U.S., and you cited probably the main reason for that would be the wildfires happening out there. Person listening to this in Kentucky might say, well, yeah, it's mostly concentrated in the West. Why does that matter to me?
Yeah, it's a good question, but it's a national problem where we see the most extreme cases are almost always going to be tied, at least in terms of air quality and in the short projection that we're looking out 30 years. We're seeing those most extreme cases in California and Oregon and Washington in areas that are already prone to wildfires. But the fastest growing region for wildfires across the country is the Southeast U.S., places like Western North Carolina, Eastern Tennessee, Eastern Kentucky, Northern Georgia, Northern Alabama. Those are the areas where we're seeing more and more of this exposure to wildfires. And the smoke then that's coming from these wildfires. And in Kentucky, if you're focused on sort of the central part of the state, in the eastern part of the state, we're really seeing two different indicators here. And in the central part of the state, especially the kind of the north central part of the state around the Louisville metro area, we're seeing increases in ozone exposure. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that heat waves are more likely in the area, and we have anthropogenic pollutions from the cars and from the industry that's in the city. But if you're in the eastern part of the state, we're starting to see a lot more PM spikes, or at least it's more common than it was in the past, as we see increases in wildfires throughout the Appalachian region, and in particular, eastern Tennessee and western North Carolina on up into eastern Kentucky. The smoke from those fires carries its way into areas that, you know, are pretty proximate, but maybe even relatively far away, like eastern Kentucky and southern Ohio.
The EPA just revised its air pollution rules for soot, basically. And is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. This PM2.5, lots of times, you know, in the 1900s, it was tracked as PM10, which is a larger size pollutant, something like you would think of as dust. PM2.5 is a little bit more of a health concern in the sense that it's even smaller. We can't oftentimes see it in the air unless it's really, really concentrated in the form of something like smoke, but we breathe that in. It has the ability to penetrate into the lungs and into the body in a way that does cause health problems. The EPA is specifically responding to some of the levels that we've already had set around the different what are called air quality index levels. They set thresholds for what's unhealthy, what's very unhealthy, what's dangerous, and even what's unhealthy for sensitive groups like elderly populations and kids. But what they've been seeing is that people are pushing back against those levels, and they're saying persistent exposure to some of these levels are unhealthy at even lower levels than what we've seen before. We're starting to see a revision of the standards attached to that.
What kinds of decisions can individuals make by using the information in your report?
On the West Coast, people live by the AQI index. They know when it's an orange day. They know when it's a red day. They know when they're staying indoors. I think with the wildfires that we saw in Canada and the increasing presence of them in the Southeast, people in the South, in the Midwest, and in the East Coast are starting to get more and more acclimated to the AQI index. They understand now what a red day is, what a purple day is. I think one of the biggest issues is that we don't build homes to account for those types of characteristics here in this part of the country. Oftentimes, you know, when we do have wildfire smoke, we'll smell it in the house, and all of a sudden we'll realize that our home is pretty drafty. We're letting in this air pollution into the house. What we've done is we've worked with an environmental engineering company called Arab, and they helped us to devise a series of solutions that we put on our riskfactor.com site to show people that there are things you can do for your home when the air is bad outside. If there is a wildfire nearby or if ozone levels are increasing, things like changing the windows could have a big impact on the property, or things like changing out the filter on your furnace system or your HVAC system are also things that folks could do. So there are solutions that people can do, some of them relatively inexpensive, that can help to protect them in terms of their indoor air quality when the outdoor air quality is bad.
Well, your latest analysis here, it allows for a look at both the current risk from bad air, but also, and you touched on this earlier, what's anticipated 30 years into the future. What does that future look like?
Yeah, we're using the global climate models that were developed by NASA. They've been downscaled. They give us the ability to understand things like temperature, drought, humidity, all the things that are related to the production of this poor air quality. And what we're finding is that across the country, there is going to be increases in poor air quality. We're actually seeing that upward trend continue into the future, somewhere between about 8 and 10% moving forward. But what that ultimately means is that in 30 years across the country, our air quality is going to be about what it was 20 years ago in 2004. And that's when we first started measuring this soot metric. Essentially, what we're doing is we're wiping away all these gains that we've made over the last few decades or half century from the regulatory policies. In the worst case scenarios, we're seeing places in the West go from having, you know, upwards of 80 or 90 poor air quality days and adding another 2 weeks worth of poor air quality days. All of a sudden, they're up over a quarter of the year with these poor air quality days. In the Kentucky region, where it's a little bit more muted. We're seeing risk at, 3 to 5 days of risk and maybe doubling over the next 30 years. So ultimately, you get to the point to where, we can say there's a week's worth of these poor air quality days that are hazardous for people's health. It doesn't sound like a lot. It's 1 week out of the entire year. But if there's a week and you can't go outside, school has to get canceled, people that work outdoors can't work outdoors, there are some quality of life impacts that people will start to feel from this increased poor air quality.
Well, Jeremy, your focus is on the implications of climate change, and I know from all of our previous interviews that First Street has really been digging deeply into this. And I'm wondering what a professional in your role who's looking at and analyzing the data takes home with him at night. What's your level of concern about the ways that we're now seeing changes happening in our climate?
It certainly is something that I worry about. I think the fact that we're able to peg these to actual observations, we're able to show that the costs associated with climate events have been increasing steadily. And in 2023, we just had more in the way of damages from climate events than we've seen in any year previously. So there are these clear kind of observable metrics to say, yeah, climate hazards are happening more often, but they're costing us more money. They're impacting us in ways that they haven't in the past. And then when you start to look at things like heat risk and air quality risk, then you start to think about quality of life metrics and you start to think about health metrics and some of those things that come out of it. Just to put it in context, since we implemented the Clean Air Act, scientists estimate that we have prevented about 250,000 premature deaths. We prevented about 200,000 heart attacks. We prevented the loss of about 17 million work days annually, and we prevented the loss of about 5.4 million lost school days for children. And so if we are reversing that trend, as a scientist, I look at it and I say, we're adding all that back. Essentially, what we're doing is we're going to be adding premature deaths and heart attacks and lost economic activity from lost work days, lost quality of life from lost school days and recreational activities. So it is impacting our daily lives in a lot of different ways, from very serious health implications all the way down to quality of life metrics.
Jeremy Porter, head of climate implications at First Street Foundation. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me on.
A new effort to monitor air quality at the community level is getting underway in March. Joining us now from the organization Appalachian Voices is Central Appalachian Senior Program Manager Aaron Savage. Welcome, Aaron.
Hi, good to be here.
Tell us about the Upper South and Appalachia Citizen Air Monitoring Project that goes into a quarterly reporting phase, I think, in March, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, this is a project we undertook when we saw an opportunity for funding through the EPA from the bipartisan infrastructure law. Air monitoring in Central Appalachia is something that we had been interested in for quite a while, but we didn't have the resources to do it. Over the last decade or so that I've been doing this work, there have been good advances in technology for low-cost air monitors that people can put up around their properties, both inside their homes and outside their homes. So that really helped us break into this type of monitoring. And then the EPA grant allowed us the extra resources to pay staff, pay travel costs, to drive around to many communities across a 5-state area to deploy these monitors.
Beginning in March, this will be the first time that it will go to a quarterly report, and we'll be keeping us updated on air quality?
That's correct. So the vision for the project, it will take place over 3 years. It technically started in early November. And what we intend to do is collect data. We'll collect it continuously, but then we'll be analyzing and reporting on it quarterly. So we've just completed a full quarter, 3 months worth of data collection at the end of January. And then we need some time to download the data and analyze it, do all of the quality assurance checks, and then write a report. So we think that'll take us about 2 months, so about the end of March, and then we will release that report publicly so that the communities taking part know what sort of results we're finding so far, and the general public as a whole. It will be preliminary. this National Ambient Air Quality Standard is an annual standard, and that is what we are comparing to. So we really want to get a full year's worth of data before we make any major conclusions. But we didn't want to make communities wait that long to see what the preliminary data is showing so far.
Well, you mentioned that there's not a regulatory purpose for the community monitoring. What do you hope to gain by making this effort?
Well, we've added, I can't remember exactly where we're at right now. I think we're at about 40 or 50 monitors deployed across the region. We're hoping to get close to 80. And that is a significant increase in particulate matter monitoring in the region. So that's the first thing we wanted to accomplish, just providing more data. Because without the data, nobody knows that there's a problem. And if we don't know there's a problem, we can't take action. Secondarily, we really hope that regulators will consider the data when they decide what areas they'll prioritize for collecting more rigorous data and looking at potential sources and then taking action to address those sources of particulate matter.
So it sounds as though up until now, people have been just pretty much in the dark about this, and this monitoring could change that, could really raise awareness.
Yes, absolutely. It should provide a lot more data, and the public reporting should increase awareness. It also is providing an active step for communities who have been complaining about concerns around air pollution for a long time. It provides them a way to really get involved and feel empowered to do something about their situation.
They can take that data and say, see, this is what we're seeing. So how about, you know, bringing your official equipment in here and confirming it?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. That's Appalachian Voices Central Appalachian Senior Program Manager, Aaron Savage. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
Those community air monitors are now up and running in Clark, Floyd, Letcher, Harlan, and Kenton counties. And if your community is interested in joining the effort, you can contact Aaron Savage. Just go to their website, App Voices, that's with two P's, appvoices.org. Jane Hicks is a teacher, poet, and fiber artist, winner of the Appalachian Writers Association 2006 Book of the Year Award in Poetry. She is the author of Blood and Bone Remember, Poems from Appalachia, and Driving with the Dead, Poems. And now, The Safety of Small Things, a meditation on mortality as viewed through the lens of one who has endured cancer, the biopsies, the chemotherapy, has observed the intersections of nature and science and the circle of life. Jane Hicks, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
So in the epitaph of your book, you quote Yeats, "The world is full of magic things, patiently waiting for our senses to grow sharper." Why did you choose that particular thought to greet the reader?
One of the main focuses of the book is to pay attention. I think it was Mary Oliver that said one of the forms of praying is to pay attention. So I wanted the reader to understand that it's not the big things sometimes, it's the small things.
And nature is just waiting there to be discovered.
Yes, you have to be out in nature to discover it.
Well, your poetry shares a discovery of grace and beauty where least expected. If you would tell us about some of the experiences that have led to places or instances where you have found that, where you found grace and beauty.
In my walkings, as I call them, or my little hikes around our woods, some of the things that are the most beautiful that I've seen have come out of my brush pile. Now, a brush pile is not a pretty thing. We always see baby bunnies pop out of there, little deer when their mamas hide them, you know, in the daytime and go off and feed. Out of that scraggly bunch of brush, you know, some of the most beautiful things have appeared, birds, all kinds of animals. But one of my favorite things from that brush pile is the variety of mushrooms and mosses that are there. And those are indeed very small things. And a moss is a wonderful thing when you look at it very closely. It's a complex thing.
Gosh, I'll never look at a brush pile the same way again. So how, in your experience, have past, present, and even future, how have they kind of come together in unexpected, maybe even surprising ways?
You know, I thought about that when I was pondering our talk today. Some of the past and the present, you know, you find out that we are concerned with the things that our ancestors were concerned with when you get right down to the bottom of things. And you realize that the things that concern us in our life are going to be the things that our descendants, you know, are concerned with. And the future, people talk about the future. I've seen several people mention that in the book, and I'm not real sure what they're talking about. It's something that has spoken to someone.
Mm-hmm. The book focuses on the experiences that you've had in terms of an experience with cancer and chemotherapy and all that goes with it. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how that inspired you to write this poetry?
Yes. It's the people that I met when I was having chemotherapy and when I was going through all the other subsequent treatments. There were so many stories of people who were, I've heard the word brave used. I'm not sure that's really the right word to be used for a person going through cancer treatment. I think persistence and steadfastness, and as one of my friends says, just put your head down and get on with it. And I'm not sure there's even time to be brave. You just have to do what you got to do. Someone gave me the advice and they said, consider this to be your job for the next year. And once I approached it that way, I think that really, really helped me. You know, I think that helped me get through it. I said, okay, this is just another task that I've got to get through. I did have a good prognosis. But it was only a good prognosis if I did X and X and X. So that was my job. I'd love to be around for my grandchildren. It's what I did. And, you know, there's a very long poem in there that's a journal. It's a reconstruction of a journal. And someone told me, they said, you better keep a journal. You better write this down because you won't remember it. Well, you do remember some things, but the minutiae and even some of the big things, I did not remember till I went back through my journal. And I reconstructed that, you know, in that poem. And there were people I wanted to remember too. And there's a term called chemo brain. And that is a very real thing. You know, the chemotherapy really scrambles your brain for a while. There's a poem in the book. When I first was able to read again, I was reading the wonderful Morris Manning, and I read one of his poems and followed it through, and that's when I knew that the chemo brain was diminishing, that I could follow one thought all the way through.
You write about the splendor and the revelation of science. This is the process that we humans use to try to understand nature and nature itself, which just works as it works, whether we understand it or not. But tell us about the splendor and revelation of science.
I probably am a very strange person in that, to my knowledge, not a single person in my family has had cancer. And that in itself is something else. But I had no idea what to do. I had no idea what I was about to go through, except for a dear friend who had been through cancer with a very bad prognosis, you know, from the beginning. And I knew it wasn't going to be like that. But it was such a revelation to me that a certain drug could hunt down a certain kind of cancer in your body and get rid of that, you know, and that a huge machine was going to beam radiation into one little spot in my body and remove that one tiny, tiny spot in my body. And if God forbid that you should ever have to lay on a radiation table and see that big thing come down, you know, over your head, and it looks like a giant eye, but all these little slots start sliding into place. And it's a click, slide, click, slide, click, slide. And they have trained it on that one spot on your body. And they tattoo you. They put tiny little tattoos on you so they can line you up the same every time. And that, you know, that science, the magic of tuning, as it were, tuning that giant machine to send a microscopic beam into me. You know, it was very wonderful. I've always been a little bit of a science geek, but this took me off in a direction, you know, that I'd never thought of. So, you know, it all came together to save this human, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jane, I wonder if you would be willing to share a reading of one of your poems from The Safety of Small Things.
Okay. When I was in the midst of my therapy, again, I was challenged to pay attention, and it was a bleak time of year, and I found out it wasn't so bleak. This is called Solstice. Winter's woods wait, neither bleak nor bare, subtle hues with flares of neon moss, limbs tipped with blushed buds wait lengthened days. Damp stone, curly lichens follow watery north light. Winter darkened deer pile tanned and wizened leaves for buried shoots and ferns. Dark cedars sport ornaments of cardinals and jays. Birds flit in the weak gloaming that flushes, then bruises, fades to shadow and sparkle under an icy moon.
That's beautiful, and it's very appropriate for the winter that we've been experiencing, as a matter of fact, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
That's Jane Hicks. She's author of The Safety of Small Things, published by the University Press of Kentucky on the Fireside Industries imprint. Fireside publishes creative work by authors who are telling the complex stories of Appalachia and rural America. The aim, according to editor Silas House, is to inform, entertain, challenge, and illuminate places and people who are often underrepresented in literature. Jane, thank you so much for sharing your poetry and your time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.